time now for the College Football Inquirer with Dan Wetzel, SI's Ross Dellinger, and SI's Pat Forty. Here's Pat, Russ, and Dan.
All right, welcome to the pod, and it is a special edition where you have a guest.
Bonus pod, right?
All right. Could be a bonus pod. I don't know. We'll see how this plays out. Yeah. Obviously, Ross and Pat are here. We also have Jack Swarbrick, the athletic director, University of Notre Dame, is joining us. And we don't like guests, but we like you. So you're already... Jack pretends he doesn't listen to the pod, but we don't believe him. His sons do. But he seems to know a lot. But that's all right. No one wants to admit that they listen. Anyway, welcome to the podcast. Jack, how are you? Everything going all right?
Everything's great. Thanks for having me on. I'm honored. And the only reason I'm not a regular listener, as I told you, is my sons give me the abridged edition after every podcast. They're loyal. Loyal listeners.
Well, we appreciate that. Who'd you hire as your basketball coach now? What's going on? Can we just direct them? No, I'm on. That is not why Jack is on, although we may get to that later. He has a proposal coming out on NIL legislation and the future of college athletics that is printed today, Thursday, in the New York Times, right?
Correct.
Times. Yep. And he's here to discuss it also. And obviously, there's a million proposals out there. But if you know anything about Jack, first off, Notre Dame sort of sits at this great confluence of so many different parts of college athletics. It's obviously a very influential place. He also tends to be on the side of getting things done, ergo the college football playoff that finally happened. He was one of the four guys that designed that. So we take his suggestions on the future of college athletics seriously. So why don't you lay out some of your proposal here on what should happen?
Thanks. I appreciate the opportunity. The first part of it is just trying to articulate some form of a cohesive view of what we should be, because what's happening now are all these sort of one-off things, right? A suggestion here, here's what Congress should do. So sort of a little bit more of a comprehensive approach. Doubling down on the notion that this thing ought to be integrated into the mission of the university, ought to be at its core education. We think there are three sort of buckets of activity that need to happen. The first is we got to get our act together as college athletics and do the things we can do. We keep sort of implying that we can't address name, image, and likeness, for example. Of course we can. We can do it in ways requiring reporting on transactions, requiring that they be transactions. None of those things will limit the market or cause somebody not to be able to participate. So we have to take that on, as opposed to looking to others to fix it for us. We're also suggesting that there be the adoption of a national class miss policy. We shouldn't be scheduling in a way that keeps you off campus for a majority of a term. And we tend to do a lot of scheduling out of deference to television or other things where we do too much of that. And so can we adopt a policy that causes students to be part of the campus community, right, to be integrated into it? I think we're making progress on the transfer portal by making it a one-time transfer. That's critical, right? We got to get out of the waiver business, where it's been interesting during the tournament to hear people have played at four schools. That's inconsistent with this notion that it's part of the experience of being at a university. The second bucket of activity does involve Congress, but on a much more limited basis than I think a lot of people have discussed it. Principal among that is drawing the key distinction that says student athletes are in fact students, they are not employees. This is the seminal issue in front of us. You're going to have administrative tribunals and courts in the coming months declare student athletes in certain cases employees. We are most concerned about that development and its implications for our students. The students I talk to, well, it's a complex issue generally don't want to be classified as employees. So we would like Congress to help us with that. There's a lot of talk about antitrust protection. I don't think it's about antitrust protection. I think it's about allowing the students to have somebody make rules that give them some competitive equity. Every sport needs competitive equity. You have a handicap in golf. Your local high school has geographic restrictions and age restrictions. Every pro sport has a way to deliver competitive equity. College athletics is the only sport anywhere in the world which doesn't. We just need to be able to make a few rules that help do that. And the people who want those rules are the competitors, the student athletes. They want to know they have a chance to win. Right now, the NCAA won't adopt anything that touches competitive equity because it knows it's going to get sued and it's probably going to lose. And that's creating a difficult circumstance, not from the economics of colleges, but from the perspective of the student's ability to think they have a chance. And that's what you want in sports. And then finally, we think there's a role for professional sports to play. We want the people who play college athletics to be motivated, at least in part, by the value of the education. In baseball and hockey, we see that happen all the time. Kids coming out of high school can make a decision. They can go to minor league baseball or they can take the college scholarship. They can go to minor league hockey or they can come play for us. And that's a really positive environment. In basketball, as long as the one-and-done rule is in place, that doesn't happen. And frankly, with NIL, it's less likely to happen in terms of student-athletes going to overseas options or otherwise. And of course, in football, it doesn't happen at all. It's a fascinating dynamic that colleges and universities bear 100% of the development costs for the National Football League. I understand why that is, but it forces everybody who's interested in trying to get to the NFL to come to college first. There has to be an alternative to that because some of them aren't really interested in the other dynamics of college. They're only interested in trying to get to the NFL. So it's a short summary of a longer piece, but those are sort of the three buckets of activity we think all need to happen to get this back where it should be.
All right. And what are some of the proposals you have, your recommended solutions, I think, is what you have on here?
Well, in each of those areas, I mean, where I mentioned our responsibilities, it's NCAA legislation that does those things. Where I mentioned Congress, it's seeking those elements into a piece of legislation, those three elements. And with the pro sports, the proposal would be simply that they give consideration to it. We have no leverage. We have no particular influence over it. We're just asking them to consider making that contribution to keeping college athletics viable.
All right. Well, let me run through this for you, and you can maybe elaborate if you think you need to. You propose the NCAA should establish a national class miss policy. Part of a college education is interaction with others in the classroom, dining hall, residence halls. I think we would all agree. And what you would be saying is you can only miss so much class. You have to be in class X percent of the time or something like that. Every school would have to agree to this?
No, we recognize that schools have different class models, right? Some have more online classes, for example. It's about not having a schedule, not building schedules that take you away from campus a certain percentage of the time. Right.
Okay. So less midweek games, stuff like that.
Yeah. I mean, you probably build a schedule any way, you know, you want. But if you said, for example, you can't miss more than one, you can't be scheduled to miss more than one third of a term. You don't even have to account for postseason, right? We can't figure that out. But you say your core schedule that you make before the year starts that every student can see, you're saying that schedule can take you off campus on class days more than 30%, 40%, whatever number you want to choose. But let's agree on it.
I like that idea quite a bit. I guess you would need conferences probably to obviously take up that model. since they do a majority of the scheduling, and you would need TV partners also to buy into that. Do you think those things are likely?
Well, I think you can certainly satisfy the television partners by, you know, over, for example, in the conference, you're just making sure that you don't have all your teams out at the same time, right? You're spacing it out, and you're still going to be able to fall within that limit. So I think that's a relatively easy one. Yeah, I mean, you could, the simplest way would be to just have conferences voluntarily adopt this and schedule accordingly. I'm not picking on any conference, but my experience is the lack of sophistication in conference scheduling is pretty amazing. You know, I can't tell you the number of times we have two teams from the same school on our campus and they don't know. you know, it's just there are efficiencies to be gained if we would look at this, but start with the parameter of, hey, build your schedule so the kids are on campus at least this much.
And that also, and I just real quick follow-up there. I mean, that also, look, a lot of coaches want to take their teams in at least 24 hours before they're going to play somebody in something, you know? So you have to factor that in as well. Is that problematic, or will coaches have to alter their travel plans themselves, or can you work with it as is?
Yeah, I think you can. I think you can work with it as is. I mean, if it's a Friday game and you stay over Saturday, if it's a Saturday game, you know, it's one class miss. We have this now. We have a very rigorous miss class policy at our school, and travel is part of the coach building a schedule that says, okay, here I'm complying with the class miss policy. So I think it's very, very doable. And in fact, it's been interesting. Schools are starting to experiment with in and out the same day. With, you know, I think it makes a lot of sense with their travel where you're like going 90 minutes or so. You know, logistically, it can be easier than the hotel room and the meals and everything else.
Jack, the last couple years or so, we've seen conferences expand and adding teams that are quite literally across the country from the footprint of that conference. How much of an issue is that when it comes to missed class time and in solving this issue?
Well, I am hopeful that a byproduct of that will be conferences redesigning scheduling models, right? I mean, as I talk to the commissioners who have some of these issues now, I know they're thinking about ways to potentially do that. The notion of conference games is an interesting one, because let's use us for an example, right? What matters to the ACC network is that we play a certain number of home games to which we have the broadcast rights and can put the game on the network. I don't know that our partners at ESPN, for example, in the network, really care whether we're playing Michigan or Michigan State, or whether we're playing Florida State or Miami. It's you don't have to build your schedule so that it's so many conference games. You could have fewer conference games. Duke and North Carolina can still play each other more, but they don't have to be conference contests. You could play more regional, more bus games, which would be much better for the student athletes. Still have the television content. In some ways, I think you'd have better television content. Be unquestionably better for the student athletes. I think that's got to be a byproduct of where we've headed in conference realignment.
You think that's, I've been advocating this for a long time, and you're kind of, interestingly, you're independent in football. You're in the ACC for most sports. You're in the Big Ten for hockey. And you, is there any others? You may be in more leagues. I don't even know. You guys are all over the place. That's it. All right. But the whole concept of, like, you know, if you're Boston College and you're playing baseball, you're probably better off playing UConn and Providence and stuff like that, and driving, or field hockey or whatever, than necessarily flying for each event. Would you ever, do you really think there is a possibility, though, that conferences would give up some of that for the good of the, I don't think there's a debate that this would be good for student athletes, particularly in the non-revenue sports, if you will. But you really think that that's a feasible proposal, that leagues would say, hey, all we really care about is football and men's basketball. Maybe we're not so bent on playing all over the place in some of the other sports.
again, I'm not sure what they're giving up. I mean, if I'm the ACC, I want BC playing UConn because UConn has a really good baseball program, right? I mean, that's great content for me. I still want to have the conference tournament, which is a big deal, and you try and win it. I want to protect conference rivalries. But the notion that we have to have 80% of our games be conference contests, look, I love our friends at Virginia Tech. We get into Blacksburg's heart. The trip to Miami is a real adventure for us. I don't think it's against the conference self-interest. I think as long as the quality of the games you're still scheduling, so you reduce the number of conference regular season, you add some high quality games that are regional, you have better crowds, better experience with student athletes, and then you still have the conference tournament. So I'm not sure what they're losing.
Right.
Yeah, a couple other points in your first bucket, so to speak, about NIL as a, you know, a non-recruiting inducement, and about getting out of the business of waivers and having a transfer portal that issues a one-time free transfer and that's it. Those both require the NCAA to be able to enforce those things and to step up, and the membership to say, we really prioritize those two things. Are both of those possible? Can we really actually get the NCAA to enforce and the membership to make it an imperative to not have NIL as a recruiting inducement and to not have waivers handed out like candy on Halloween?
Wait a minute. This had to be practical? No, I look, if we can't start to get ourselves to where we can make rational decisions like those and enforce them, I don't know what the future is. The future is going to be more than one athletic association. I can tell you that. That's almost a given. These are not restricted coaches' positions or, you know, something else that would be viewed as having broad anti-competitive implications. They're tied to the experience of the student athlete. I think the transfer portal is the easiest one, right? We want you to be part of the place you choose to go. You may want to reconsider that decision. That's fine. We'll facilitate you getting somewhere else. But we can't see the benefit in you going to three or four schools and having an experience that's what we're trying to do if it's part of the educational mission of the place. So I think we can. Now, will there be circumstances that are extraordinary? Family crises, yeah, and we ought to respond to that, but not like we do now. Any plausible explanation gets you has historically gotten you away. So I do think we can do that. I recognize that in the NIL space, or NILI as we call it, going to be a little harder, but we just need to make some progress. We're not going to fix everything. But I think if you have to report the transaction, right, you're required to disclose. And secondly, it has to be a transaction related to commercial value in some form, right? What did you do for this money other than to attend the university? Give me those two things, which aren't radical, and they're not going to solve the entire problem. I mean, look, people were paying under the table for as long as I've been around. Now it's the same payment. They call it NIL. So we're not going to solve it. It's not going to all go away. But we got to get out of this position where the vast majority of the transactions that are occurring are not what they're being characterized as. Educational institutions ought to be embarrassed to be part of that, right? Okay, we're going to conduct a fraud here. This is not what we're saying it is, but we're going to call it that. So, yeah, I think we can do it. Are we going to eradicate all the problem? No, but I think it'd be a heck of a lot better.
You're relying, Jack, on the schools to police themselves in a lot of this. I mean, these are guidelines and rules right on the books now, and we're seeing that they're not being followed. Why would they be followed ever?
In NIL, I question whether they're guidelines that are in place. I think there was a wholesale retreat by the NCAA after the Alston case. And so I don't think anyone views, and the enforcement activity since then sort of reinforced that it may not be present. I agree with you on the transfer rule. They've been in place. The waiver was supposed to be hard to get, and it wasn't. You know, if you're right, and that's the answer, we can't fix it. We can't get better at that. It's a sad day, but it may be the answer. I must say, I'm very encouraged by Charlie Baker and the leadership he's bringing, and I'm gonna bet on him to help us make some changes.
Well, I agree with you on the transfer. I've always said they never should have done the waivers. Obviously, there's been an enormous number of uncles on dialysis machines that have popped up that have helped the cause of immediate eligibility, and we wish all those people thoughts and prayers with the uncles. But you probably were better off never allowing any of it, because sitting out 1 year of college for free is not a punishment. That's not punishment. That's opportunity in general. However, when it comes to NIL, what I question is, why is this a problem? What's the problem with NIL being used to draw students to a school?
There's no problem with NIL being used to draw students to a school. The issue
I'm saying, how about using it as an inducement? I'll go straight up. What's the problem if I'm a booster and I say, I'm a Notre Dame booster, and I say, I'll give you $500,000. You come play quarterback for us. Well, and you send out some tweets about my cement mixing business in Wichita.
Yeah. So there are two things there. The first is the question of why the straight inducement is a problem. I mean, why do you even have to put it on, right? Why can't the head of the concrete company just pay me to go to that school in addition to my scholarship?
Exactly.
The answer for me goes back to competitive equity, right? I mean, that's going to, in a non-structured way, different than any other sport in the world, right? There's no entry draft. There's no salary cap. There's no anything. Is going to cause a skewing of the decisions, if you will, and a competitive inequity that's just going to be part of college athletics. I recognize historically some of that's been the case. And maybe the answer is, sorry, that's what college athletics is always going to be. But I hate the competitive consequence. And I hate the way that says, you know what? Don't worry about school. We're paying you X to go be quarterback. And, you know, just do the minimum, but be our quarterback for this much money. So it's a tough environment.
Well, let me follow up.
It's tough to get that kid to go to study hall.
Well, let me follow up. I mean, you're offering money and the opportunity to go to college, which some kids would certainly take, especially at a place like Notre Dame. But I guess the perception is always that this is a problem. We have not seen so far in the NIL era where all the talent is becoming less equitably distributed. It's actually flat, as economists predict, or a little bit more spread out. Every school can prioritize a player and overbid on this player opposed to someone else. There's still playing time opportunities. I think there's been a consensus that this is a problem because it's new, but I still haven't seen any actual thing that's a problem. And I would even posit for some place like Notre Dame, which I do believe has tried through the years to not be involved in pay-for-play games the way maybe other people are, this is actually a massive benefit, because certainly you have plenty of alums with some money. Your most famous building is a golden roof, not a broke place. I've never walked around South Bend and said, boy, if only this place got a couple bucks behind it. Where's the concrete problem of the problem before we find a solution? And I know I kind of just asked that, but I just feel like this is the single biggest point to drill down on, is where's the problem?
Yeah. First of all, a sort of preface to it, and then I'll, a direct answer. You talked about the NIL payment in your comment as if it were the only financial transaction, right? The student comes to Notre Dame on a full scholarship.
Sure.
We're paying about $100,000 direct benefit to room, board, books, tuition, additional educational benefits, cost of living, some of the other things the NCAA lets us do. That compares really favorably to minor league sports, which ought to be the comparable here. So, first of all, you know, the NCAA spent so much time and wasted so much energy and money defending amateurism, which is a ridiculous proposition. I mean, if somebody has to explain to me someday why amateurism is a positive characteristic.
Preach, brother, preach.
Yeah.
No one ever said, boy, the babysitter's experience would be a lot better if we didn't pay him or
her. Hallelujah. You're only an amateur in things you're bad at.
Yeah. It's a long list in my case. So the first is there is a financial transaction at the core of this that is related to you getting an education. And that's the premise of this, right? It's like, what the heck are colleges and universities doing running minor league sports programs where the participants are getting paid salaries for the sport, and it has nothing to do with being a member of the university community? And that's what happens when NIL becomes just the inducement, right? I mean, I've sort of been a little facetious before, but it really does become, go to class, go to study hall. No. You're paying me X to come play football, and that's what I'm going to do for you. Leave me alone. We've got the nature of the relationship wrong. And I'm all for, as I said earlier, I love the baseball player and hockey player who's talented enough to go right in and pursue their pro dream. No one ever said that, you know, Jordan Spieth should have stayed at Texas longer, or the Williams sisters should have, you know, not gone pro when they did. We're all for that. That's not what college, that's not the job or the industry college ought to be involved in. That's the essence of it.
To that point, you're one of your other buckets is the role of pro sports, and hey, let's have an NFL minor league. Now, we've seen some NBA minor leagues that have kind of popped up, G League, the overtime elite, things like that, and it hasn't ruined college basketball. But right. I wonder what the impact would be on college football if you had a minor league that was populated with enough players to have multiple teams out there, and who would those players be that were taken away from college football? Would it hurt the enterprise significantly? And then secondly, is there any way the NFL goes for that when they've got the golden goose, as you pointed out? Right now, it's all on the colleges.
Yeah, I don't think Commissioner Goodell's read the New York Times this morning. He's going to call and thank me. I recognize that of all the things we're talking about here, that is the one we can least likely cause to happen, and probably is least likely to happen relative to the impact. And I recognize football is football. It's the dominant activity, but every other sport suggests to us it's not a problem. College baseball has never been more popular than it is right now, and it's doing great. I tell you, Big Ten hockey, and I know other hockey programs, are thriving. I know that those top draft picks would have made college better, but you're rooting for Notre Dame or you're rooting for Michigan. And as long as there's, you know, the relative talents produce good competition, I think that's what matters. So maybe there'd be some reduction in interest, but so far, there's no minor league in any sport that I've seen hurt the comparable college sport.
Jack, you know, Charlie Baker was up here in D.C. I think the last couple of weeks meeting with senators and such about a congressional bill or solution of some sort to this, to the NIL. If you don't get that in the next few years, and if schools can't enforce and police themselves on this issue, if the NCAA can enforce and police rules or guidelines, what happens? Like, we have another association that's more professional. Like, what happens?
Well, as I suggested earlier, I think there's a lot we can do without Congress. And I think we're a little too quick to say, woe is us, and Congress come help us, you know. And as productive as a lot of the conversations I've had on the Hill have been, and how engaged the senators and congressmen are, I'm a realist, you know. They might want to figure out how to fund the national government before they take on college athletics.
That's a thought.
Or elect a speaker in less than first 15 rounds. So I think it's a mistake to look there as primary. I think they have an interest in it, especially as it relates to the status of students. And as these cases come down, and they're coming in the next few months, where student athletes in certain jurisdictions will be declared employees, I think that will be the call to action that will get them engaged. And it may be just at that level. But if that's all that we got out of it, that would be an enormous help.
Let me piggyback off of that employee, you know, athletes becoming employees. Some coaches are, I think, in ADs too, are to the point where, you know, this is like an unregulated free agency type of situation. And they want regulation, and they believe that, hey, you know, deeming a college athlete an employee would bring regulation and contracts, right, and binding agreements and all that. So why, from your vantage point, is it bad to consider them employees?
Because it separates them from the rest of the students even more than they are now, puts them in a separate class. Virtually everything about them starts to become different. So right now, if there's a disciplinary action on our campus, student affairs handles it. Well, now it'll be the HR department if you're an employee. That happens completely differently. When you're applying the Fair Labor Standards Act rules and for 40 hours a week and overtime, if as part of your participation in the sport, I require you to go to class, does that become part of the 40 hours? And so if practice ran long, I'm now getting overtime for my biology class. It just creates a completely different category that's inconsistent, again, with the mission of what we're doing. And I want them to get benefit, financial benefit, from being student athletes, and they do. We're just so reluctant to refer to that as compensation when it is. It's how universities compensate, and they have forever, for all kinds of students. So, you know, I think it's that separation. I also don't think it's a solution people think it is. Now, I understand that if we could collectively bargain on this, we would be in great shape in terms of antitrust mm-hmm. lawsuits, right?
Mm-hmm. Right.
I can't figure out how that works, and maybe somebody has the explanation, but the reason the NLRB brought the action against USC, the Pac-12, and the NCAA is because they know you can't collectively bargain with just one school. Probably doesn't work to do it by conference, so they want to do it nationally. I mean, imagine if we bargained by conference. In one conference, the students bargain for 10 games, and in another, they bargain for 12 games. What does that do? How does postseason work? How does all that come together? This NLRB will want to represent micro units, so just the football team or just the basketball team. I think the students, at least the students I deal with, would rather have it be the student athletes as a whole, where you're going to get very different results then. So there's a complexity to this that I think people don't fully appreciate yet, although I understand the frustration with, maybe that's a better solution than what we have now. We don't think it is.
I wonder, you know, about the commonality of the belief system. I accept your passion for the process and student athletes and the benefits of the education system, but you're talking about things like the university disciplinary system. You don't have to look very far into this NCAA basketball tournament to see places where There's no disciplinary system.
None of anybody in mind there?
Pretty much do anything you want, as long as you're not behind bars. And how do you find find all of these different schools to agree to a standard that perhaps a Notre Dame prefers or that has this value? Is there really a shared value? And I understand it's a voluntary joint athletic, the association is what it is, the NCAA. But is there really a commonality on how student athletes should be treated when we see literally none of that in practice, one school to the other, and it's just sort of how it works?
Man, you've hit my favorite topic. That's our problem, right? Every association, every business association requires some commonality of interest to function, right? I don't care whether it's the American Medical Association or whatever it is. We have the more than 1,100 members of the NCAA, you can't find that commonality. And we have to recognize that. Either get to the place where we can divide ourselves, where we do have common interests, and there's another athletic association. Or get enough people within the current association to say, these will be the standards. This is the commonality we have to share. And if you're not on board, you're not in the association. It's always struck me that of all the penalties the NCAA levies, some of which are incredibly ineffective, they never terminate membership. That's a penalty that would matter. And we gotta drive to that. I couldn't agree more. We lack a commonality of interest. And a lot of this, if it's going nowhere, it's because of that.
Well, this is at the heart, right, of how schools are using NIL, right? I mean, there's some schools using it this way, and there's some schools using it that way. Some schools not using it at all. I mean, Jack, we saw a school recently located in the SEC that has announced with fanfare that they are basically, their foundational arm, at least, is, you know, using an NIL collective. Their NIL collective's underneath their foundation fundraising arm. So, and there's other schools that gasp at that, right? We would never do such. And now schools in that same conference, the SEC, I think they're all looking at, well, if they can get away with it, we've got to do it too. I know this is kind of a narrow question about maybe that specifically, but we're seeing a lot of schools get closer and closer, Jack, to having NIL on their campus, like having a collective under their school umbrella. Curious if you think this is some kind of trend. We're going to see this more, and how concerned does that make you in the future?
Well, in the absence of anybody doing anything to try and come up with enforceable rules or enforce them, absolutely you'll see more of it. I don't know if there's any question. But it will further drive division among the schools because not everybody's going. And, you're going to see cases of students who might have otherwise considered school A and B who won't because school A and B isn't offering that same financial opportunity. And maybe that's just the consequence we're all going to live with. I think there are going to be some bad stories come out, as there already have, where the student wasn't put in a better position. But even independent of that, I think it's going to just drive more of a wedge among the membership of the association. I mean, I was making the point recently that I had talked to some NFL people and asked how many players on an NFL roster have marketing deals. And
very few.
I was getting like 8, 10. I talked to an agent the other day and I said, you know, I'm hearing 8 or 10. He said, try 3 or 4.
Really?
You know, that's the reality of when the market is working relative to the value of name, image, and likeness. Got 85 guys on one football team with NIL deals? So, you know, sorry. It's not NIL.
But yeah. Why is it a bad thing?
Well, it's not bad if the goal is only to maximize revenue to the individuals. I agree with you. And that maybe that
you can get paid and still care about your education. I worked when I was at college. I worked it for the school. Lots of people work. You can be paid and say, I can be the star quarterback and still care, the same way that's always been the case. Where, yeah. I mean, star quarterback is quite the same as your average Bryce Young, whether he was in a Dr. Pepper commercial or not, or if he just got $1 million or 10 bucks or whatever, people just handing him money, was ever going to be the same as the regular student at Alabama. Like, what? It's just, where's the problem that needs to be solved?
Well, because I'm happy to concede that there are some young men and women who, even in that environment, will value the education and the experience, right? But I think it's unquestionable that if that is increasingly the way we go in terms of attracting people to the institution, you're going to have fewer and fewer care about the educational dimension because they signed up for a different deal. And in some cases, they signed up for a deal with somebody who doesn't work at the university. And now, who am I reporting to in exchange for this money? Is it the person who just paid me $250,000? Or is it my coach? And if the coach doesn't start me, and that guy comes to me and says, you need to transfer, who's involved there? That's so inconsistent with the experience of everybody else that's what we're concerned about.
I'm going to briefly derail this topic, since we have somebody who leads the athletic department at the single most attractive expansion target in college athletics.
I would imagine talking expansion. Yeah.
No. I'm going to assume, but please feel free to refute me if Notre Dame will want to maintain its current situation, its status. But how do you see the rest of the landscape everywhere else as we go forward?
Well, I think we've seen sort of phase one was the moving of some of the assets, right, from here to there. Phase two has been the separation of two conferences, in part as a result of those changes, in part of the result of some smart moves they made, especially relative to media. I think the big next issue is, can we keep the perception of college athletics as involving all of us, or do the Big Ten and the SEC become college athletics in sort of popular perception? And if they do, how does that influence shape the future of college athletics?
What would it take for Notre Dame to join a conference?
Other than papal intervention, we'd have to have
just means more.
That's exactly right. So there are three things we have to have. One is we have to have a road to the national championship, a fair road, and with the expansion, we think we do. Secondly, we have to have people who want to play us, and I got to tell you, that has never been a problem. In my time here, every phone call I've made in 15 years, the party on the other side has said, "Oh yeah, let's play, let's do a home and home." Third, we have to have a committed media partner, and committed in two ways. We expect every one of our games to be broadcast nationally, and we expect to be paid in a manner that allows us to compete with the Big Ten and the SEC. So, those three things are in place. We're staying independent. At least as long as I'm around.
When you go back, just slightly back to the whole concept of reorganizing it, could you ever see, or would you ever support something where football, which is the economic driver of all of this, is dealt with differently than all of the other sports? And maybe throw in basketball, men's and women's basketball. But if you just take that out, if you take football and say, this is what we're doing over here, and this is what everyone else is, because it seems like we have all sorts of, if you run an entire athletic department, most of our listeners don't really care about anything other than football, right? But you are handcuffed with all of these other thought processes that, you know, one of the beauties of the NFL, Roger Goodell, as you said earlier, he does not wake up wondering, you know, how his field hockey league is doing. He just worries about football. Could you ever see where at least legislatively or as an entity, football is one thing, the rest of the athletic departments work in a different way?
Yes. I mean, I hate the notion, but I think there are a number of factors that might cause that to occur. You know, we have 26 sports. Football makes money. Men's basketball makes a little bit of money. And otherwise, it's the net on football that pays for everything else. And I worry that if you separate it out, the sort of over time, the tolerance for that, the willingness to say, okay, football is 86% of your revenue in Notre Dame, and it takes about half of that and pays for all the other sports. I'm afraid the sort of willingness to support that model would erode, so I'd hate that.
Willingness from who?
From the participants in football.
The players, yeah.
Well, coaches, players, administrators.
So is it fair that the players right now have to fund everything else without being asked for that agreement?
See, you know, it's the way the university works, every university, right? The medical school probably makes money. I don't think there's a survey of the medical students and the interns as to whether they're okay that that part of the university makes money. A business school probably makes money. The philosophy department doesn't. That's central to the university model.
Yeah.
Jack, I think you and Pat maybe talked about this last spring when he visited there, but do you still contend that ultimately there will be a separate association of 30 to 40 schools breaking off in doing a more professionalized, you know, model?
Believe strongly that a single athletic association isn't viable in the long term here, given all the dynamics that are going on. As I should have implied earlier, I think there's as likely a chance that there's a split off culturally as economically. So we'll see. I think either could happen, and both could sort of come together. I mean, frankly, not to get too narrow on the details, you could see the Big Ten and the SEC with different models, still very highly competitive, sort of attracting other schools and having that be the two forms of athletic association.
One thing we haven't touched on, Jack, is the state, the bill in California that would require its schools to share revenue if it makes a certain amount, which the Pac-12 schools in that state, Big Ten schools in that state and Pac-12 schools in that state would have to share revenue if this bill passes. And many believe this bill will pass in the state house and assembly, and that it will be another, you know, it will open the door kind of like NIL did, kind of like California did for NIL, opening the door for that. This would open the door for revenue sharing. What would happen if this passes California?
Well, I'll answer that, but first I have to point to my favorite part of that legislation, which is that if you reduce a roster spot,
you're fired. I knew this was coming. Yeah. Suspended 3 years.
Eliminate a sport, the athletic director is suspended for 3 years.
Where do you think you go for 3 years, Jack? You're suspended. You're suspended for 3 years. Where do you go? You go to an island or what?
Well, it's not only that, but if I'm suspended with pay, I'm cutting a roster spot tomorrow.
Yeah.
one volleyball player got.
Yes. Swarbrick is relocated to an island for 3 years.
Pay your own way.
It's such an interesting piece of legislation. And you know, you wonder, since jurisdictionally it can only apply to California schools, sort of how that works, especially if you're in a conference like the Big Ten. But if for schools that are really top-heavy in their revenue model, like USC and Notre Dame are with football, right, the transfer is extraordinary. We calculated ours at about $58 million. You know, and the students are getting $25,000 a year under the bill. The rest goes into a trust fund that they get to access under what basis, I don't know, upon graduation. You know, that's 58 million is a lot of money. And it I don't know how, literally don't know how it would be possible to not have any of those reductions that would get me suspended, but have a transfer of cash of that size. I'm just not sure how we could figure it out. I mean, obviously I have to do something, but not sure what form it would take.
Well, and let me play devil's advocate here, and I agree with what you're saying, but I think, I think it's in your op-ed as well about how, you know, so many people believe that, you know, every school turns this massive profit, and it's just not the case. I think that, again, the devil's advocate of that is you would turn a massive profit if you didn't, one, spend so much on coaches, and two, spend so much on facilities. Could you reduce those two things and then use that money to, you know, pay athletes in some way?
It would be stupid to say, no, you couldn't produce any additional revenue. But I also think it's important to understand the broader picture. There are some very, very highly compensated coaches at Notre Dame and other places. On average, across all our coaches, including those highly compensated ones, the average compensation doesn't look very different than a tenured professor, because, you know, we had volunteer coaches. Those are now going away via NCAA legislation. But there are a lot of coaches across our 26 sports that don't make much money. So, yes, we would produce some, but this notion of all kinds of really highly compensated individuals, it's the 10 countable football coaches and, you know, probably both genders of basketball coaches and then an occasional other. The facilities, every place is different, but our commitment is to great facilities. We build great labs. We build great dormitories. The thing you should look at every university is, over time, how has the capital spend on athletics changed relative to the capital spend of the university on other facilities? Ours has been, in my 15 years, has had very little movement in terms of the percentage of the university spend. And we built some beautiful facilities, some great facilities. My point is, that's what universities are doing generally now, which is investing in facilities that attract the best students in the country. And athletics is just doing that as part of the university.
That's true. I mean, you don't go on any campuses really anymore and don't see cranes somewhere. You know, it's not just an athletic thing, but the salary thing's a whole other deal, in my opinion.
Let me ask you this. Since you brought up the salaries and the students that you have to pay the scholarships to, outside of your revenue sports, you say, let's say 22 of your sports or something, 23 of your sports, considering the intense desire of people to attend university in Notre Dame, you know, whatever you guys let in on a normal basis, 10, 15% of the applicants, and the applicants alone have sorted themselves out. Most people say, I don't have a chance, I'm not applying. But a very low percent get in. The intense desire to go to Notre Dame, the even more intense desire to be able to play sports at Notre Dame. If you got rid of scholarships for all of these other 20, 22, 23 sports, whatever this number would be, how different would your teams be? Would it not be the almost the exact same kids?
You're posing if everyone did it across college athletics.
Yes, everyone did it across college athletics. You went the Ivy League route and you said, everyone's paying, we're not spending money on scholarships. But what we are offering you is entrance to Notre Dame, all of our incredible facilities, the marketing opportunities of being a Notre Dame, all the positives of being a Notre Dame swimmer, field hockey player, soccer player, whatever that would be, which is incredibly desired. Would it be any different in a substantial manner if you had no scholarships as to having scholarships?
If it worked as you posited, no, it wouldn't. What it would do, of course, would so. I actually love the model where everybody is in the same financial aid universe, right? And we're evaluating you based on need or merit, depending upon how the need and merit programs work in university. I love that. The challenge is that there's probably nobody in the alumni base who's saying, this senior in high school who wants to be an engineer at Notre Dame is really great. I'm going to pay him to go to Notre Dame. Whereas there may be somebody in the lacrosse alumni base or in the swimming alumni base who's going to do that. And I think that's a little bit of the challenge. But as you're
so that would be like the competitive advantage of certain, is that what you're saying? It would tilt the
it would be, and again, it fundamentally changes the model. I gave you financial aid based on your FAFSA form and our assessment of how much you needed. I didn't know you were getting $80,000 from this guy over here. So it skews it a little bit.
Would getting rid of that component, and I understand politically this would be, I get yelled at in this own podcast for suggesting this thing.
I'm going to yell at you again in a minute.
Highly unpopular, but I also know that most of this, costs a lot of money to train a college athlete. It is not most of the college athletes. Many of your college athletes have spent a lot of money for the opportunity to play at Notre Dame. But if you did that and went non-scholarship, would it not solve many of these hurdles of how the heck do we make all 600 members of our athletic department employees? I don't know how many players you have at your school, but it's probably hundreds, right? 600-700 student athletes, employees, instead of, oh, we only have to pay or deal with 100 of them that are employees and they happen to be on the basketball and football teams.
Yeah, I still don't like the separation, but I have always been intrigued by the notion of let's have the financial aid model work the same for everybody. You're still, admissions is still taking into the fact you're a great goalie, right?
Right.
Just as they take into consideration you're a great musician, and that's fine. But yeah, I've always been intrigued by first person I ever heard articulated was Gene Smith, probably 12 or 13 years ago, where he said we got to think about this. Mm-hmm. So yeah, now the interesting thing is when you compete against the Ivy League schools, the coaches will frequently say, I'm limited to 13 scholarships. Everybody on their roster is on scholarship because their financial aid models are so lucrative.
But in certain sports, they're capable of, first the Princeton's in the Sweet 16, but certainly lacrosse and certain other sports they can compete very well. Anyway, Pat, you hear this? Jack is kind of agreeing, and Jack is smart. This is like the guy. So,
now I'm smart because I apparently disagreed with Pat.
You weren't that smart to Wetzel a few minutes ago.
It's a good system. Look, not everyone is going to get all the way to my level, but Jack's on his way. You are in the caveman time, so we're making progress here.
Yeah. Okay. Go ahead and make sure you check all your diversity boxes when you're solely just giving out your non-revenue roster spots to people that don't need scholarships.
Well, you know what? Go ahead, Jack.
Go ahead. No, go ahead.
Oh, I was going to say we haven't talked about that's connected to all of this is the Ivy League's model is under fire, right?
Right.
I mean, Jack, you have a law degree. The class action lawsuit filed against the Ivy League institutions saying that they violated antitrust laws by not awarding scholarships, which I've heard from some people actually in the Big Ten recently about this. They fear impacts of what this could have on everybody nationally. Curious of your thoughts.
Well, first of all, never confuse having a law degree with knowing anything about the law. So, my sense of it is, given the other cases that have focused on agreements among universities to do anything relative to financial aid or admission or anything, it feels like a case that probably has some merit. I'm just not sure what the damages are going to turn out to be. Because, as I say, many of these schools have very generous financial aid packages. If I gave you the scholarship as allowed by the NCAA, keep in mind that in the equivalency sports, you know, you're not coming close to full tuition. I wonder if they're damages.
Yeah.
I wonder if the amount distributed under the current model wouldn't prove to be more than the amount distributed if college, if athletic scholarships were given.
Right, because there's caps on each team is what you're saying. And so people get a third of a scholarship where right now they're getting a higher number. All right, anything else pressing or can we get on to the main event here? Everyone else good? Okay, this has been a very serious, deep topic pod. We thank you, Jack, for coming on and hearing it all. Now, as you know, because I do believe you listen, I'm not going to take your you've heard of the People's Court we have here. Yeah. And you have actually do have a law degree from Stanford. It is not, that is not as prestigious as a journalism degree from the University of Massachusetts, I understand. But hopefully you can keep up with us here. We handle the pressing questions of society. And we have a doozy today, so we do need your expertise, okay? So this is our highest honor, by the way.
Yeah.
So welcome to the family. I mean,
first of all, let's just say, I believe you're only the second guest we've ever had, and the other one was on his way to prison. But still, it was a good guest, so... you're in elite company for sure.
That is true. That is true. All right. Our legal case here is this, a Chicago man, named Ayman Hallam, has filed a federal lawsuit, class action lawsuit against Buffalo Wild Wings, Buffalo Wild BW3. We're all fans of it. And, he is alleging that he went in and ordered some boneless wings and was duped, unfairly duped, by the boneless wings. And the problem was specifically, as I'm reading from the lawsuit, the name and description of the product, boneless wings, leads reasonable consumers to believe the products are actually chicken wings. In other words, the products are chicken wings that have simply been deboned and as such are comprised entirely of chicken wing meat. Unbeknownst to the plaintiff and other consumers, the products are not wings at all, but instead slices of chicken breast meat deep fried like wings. Indeed, the products are more akin in composition to a chicken nugget rather than a chicken wing. This is a clear-cut case of false advertising. It should not be permitted. And he is seeking unspecified damages on behalf of the class. So let's start with Jack. I got to hear your thoughts on this. Does our plaintiff have a case that he was unfairly duped into eating chicken nuggets when he thought it was a chicken wing? Or, as Buffalo Wild Wings has responded in a deal, it's true, our boneless wings are all white meat chicken. Our hamburgers contain no ham. Our buffalo wings are 0% buffalo. So is this guy just too big of an idiot that he believed in the menu, or does he have a case here?
Well, first of all, the gravity of this issue makes everything we talked about in the first hour.
Yeah. Look at sequential. College sports are popular, but so isn't chicken.
Yeah,
chicken is very popular. So,
I must say this raises a really significant existential question. Since chickens really don't fly, is the chicken wing a wing? You know, they sort of, if you scare them, they flutter a little bit and jump. But they don't fly. It's like flying squirrels, which lived in our attic for over a year. They don't really fly, they glide, right? So I first question whether there's any chicken wing anywhere that's really a wing. So that would be my first defense.
This
here.
Is the Stanford big brain That's, stuff.
Yeah, yeah, yeah,
show
yeah,
off right away. He's got to show right. off.
There you
gone completely macro here. Can you? Is it even a wing if it doesn't help you fly? I'm gobsmacked here. Yeah.
The buffalo is also Buffalo, New York, not an actual buffalo.
But thank God, it doesn't actually have Buffalo, New York in it.
All right. Well, that's okay. That's a fair point. Ross, how do you rule on this? Consumer or but BW3s?
No, I'm going with BW3s, man. You know, I mean, I'm a bone-in guy, I don't do a whole lot of boneless. I always get the bone in on pretty much everything. So I don't deal with the other chicken wing anyway, and they can call it what they want. It's not as good as the bone in, so I don't care.
Pat?
First of all, if you haven't seen the Gary Larson cartoon from the Boneless Chicken Farm, the Far Side guy, it's like hilarious. It's a bunch of chickens flopping around, lying around like boneless entities. But I'm with the consumer here because this is ridiculous. It's always bothered me. For it sure. has offended me for a long time that these are called boneless chicken wings when that they are. Yes, they are chicken parts pressed together into a disc, more or less. It's not a wing. Don't call it a wing. I don't want it. So I'm with the consumer 100% here.
It's a nugget.
I think there has to be an intelligence test that is agreed upon when you walk into BW3s. You have to at least be smart enough to understand that, like, the popcorn shrimp is not popcorn. There's no popcorn in the shrimp. It's just a term.
It's a bad term. Change the term. Make it accurate.
Go ahead, Jack.
And hopefully the hot dog is not really a dog.
Yeah, hopefully. Fingers crossed.
Yeah, you never know.
This is good. I am on the side of BW3s.
Nah.
Judgment for them. I'm hoping they send me a coupon or something for the publicity. I don't know. This one, I mean, we've had some good ones. There was a one a while ago. But is there any strawberries in the strawberry Pop-Tart? That, I think, is a fair argument. Yeah, this is those things stink anyway for like 6-year-olds. What is this guy doing? Part of the chicken wing is gnawing on the bone. That's part of the thing.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, and he's being deprived that. You order a wing and you get no bone. So,
yeah, but false advertising. You order boneless. They're not lying about the boneless part.
The description boneless is pretty specific.
It is, but don't call it a wing, man.
So would you prefer they call it a bony nugget when the bone is
there? Yeah, bony nugget.
There you go.
Good point.
Just go.
The lawsuit suggests they call it chicken poppers like some other restaurant does. But I don't know. What's a popper? Anyway, there we are. See what you're missing? This is the stuff we need. Is there really a wing on a chicken?
Now you know why your sons listen, Jack. See?
I want to know what the compensation model is for the attorney bringing that lawsuit.
Well, this isn't even – there's one guy who sues all the companies for false advertising, and it actually isn't even his lawsuit, so it's a different one. He's got some competition in the completely frivolous food class action suit thing. I don't know. Maybe
There's an attorney that basically has like a monopoly on all these false advertising lawsuits. Yeah.
Remember, most of these stories come from the same guy.
Wow.
Yeah. Wetzel said that was the only other guest he would like to have. Like this guy, you can get that lawyer.
He has an open invitation to come on and explain why the Pop-Tart doesn't have enough strawberry.
I'm sure he would come on.
I mean, I don't know. I got to reach out.
Jack, you missed the boat on that one. See, you could be fighting that in court every day, false advertising.
Yeah.
Be careful what's at your concession stand.
Yeah.
You might want to review that.
Believe me, there are a few things that trigger letters to an athletic director, like a 25-cent change in the cost of popcorn.
I can believe that.
Inflation, man, it's tough. All right, Jack, thank you so much for coming on. It was a very detailed excellent discussion, NIL and all this stuff is changing the sports that we love and follow here and in all sorts of different ways. So to hear from the ground up, you are welcome back anytime, even if you just want to do the People's Court. Well, so stay in touch with us here.
Thank you. I appreciate it very much. I appreciate the opportunity, especially to participate in People's Court. And I want to apologize since you identified where my law degree is from, that I devalued Brooke Forty's degree now.
Yeah.
She's slightly lessened by the association, but get by.
I'm sure your law professors would be proud to hear your participation in this.
They are scrambling to see if I actually attended.
I remember that guy. Yeah. Yeah. All right. Thank you. Everyone else, feel free to continue to subscribe, share us on social media, tell your friends about us, hum the Notre Dame fight song, do the thunder on, what is it? Thunder, how's it say? Thunder down, shake the thunder down. What is it, Jack? Shake the what?
I thought you were going AC/DC on me with
thunder. Thunder sticks. Not handle the victors. I know that. Anyway, shake whatever.
Down, shake down the thunder from the
shake
sky.
Down the thunder, yes. From the sky. You know, Newt Rockne, whatever we got to do. Thank you for listening. We will talk to you later.